As you watch the screen, your heart begins to beat faster. There's a fluttering in the pit of your stomach. Your throat is dry. Your palms damp. Suddenly a chill runs down your spine. You clutch the person next to you. You tell yourself, it's only a movie.
It's only a movie. But sooner or later, it's time to go home.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Ron.
Thrill me, I'm Jerry.
And we're here to talk about Night of the Creeps, starring Tom Atkins, Jason Lively, Steve Marshall, and Jill Whitlow. Written and directed by Fred Decker, released in 1986 on a $5 million budget, grossed just under $1,600K at the box office, but found its footing on home video and has become a certified cult classic. But first of all, we're at the end of Shocktober. I can't believe we've made it this far, but we had to go out with a real bang and bring on our friend Jerry from Totally Rad Christmas. Jerry, welcome back to Filmstrip. Tell folks again about you and your awesome show.
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I'm great. I'm glad to be back. It's always fun talking to you guys. So I host Totally Rad Christmas. It's all about Christmas in the 80s. Sometimes I stretch the definition of what constitutes Christmas, but sometimes I also stretch what constitutes 80s, so it works out. You can find me anywhere you find podcasts, and totallyradchristmas.com will get you everywhere. So, thanks again.
Absolutely. Well, we were talking about doing this, and we were putting together the lineup for Shocktober. And I mean, at this point, you all know what we've had, and we're trying to have guests on, and we're like, we need to do 80s, you know, something 80s horror again. And Ron and I have been talking about doing this one for a long time, so it's been on our radar. But I want to know, Jerry, kind of what your background with Night of the Creeps is.
All right. So I remember seeing this when I was little, probably way younger than I should have. And the things that always stuck out to me were the axe, you know, the "I killed you already," you know, and the axe just kind of falls, and the hand grab, you know, at the very beginning when they're like, you know, stealing the corpse. And so, like, those always just stuck out to me. I remember being scared out of my mind and never wanting to see it again because, at that point, I was still terrified of like the Thriller video. So it was just one of those where I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then about 15 years ago or so, I rediscovered it, watching it with a friend, and it's awesome. And I love this movie. It's like everything that you want a cheesy 80s horror movie to be. It's a phenomenal pastiche. And it's not really a spoof, but it's kind of a send up of like all these tropes, and it's just rolled into like this serious joint. And I love it.
I can't sum it up better than that. Lindsay, what about you? What's your background with Night of the Creeps?
I just saw it for the first time for this specific show. That's why I love doing this podcast with you guys. The number of times I've said, I just saw it for the first time for this show. they're numerous. But I can't believe I haven't seen it before. I really can't. It's got everything that I hold so dear all in one movie. The only thing really it was missing was dinosaurs, to be honest. Like, it had everything. And I loved it. It was so great. It was right up my alley. So really glad that we put this one on the docket.
Ron, now I think you and I are both going to be the huge fans here along with Jerry on this. But when did you first get introduced to Night of the Creeps?
The VHS box at my local mom and pop video store was probably and that is the VHS box that has been permanently burned in my memory. I've got two of them.
Yeah,
one is Night of the Creeps and the other is this movie I've never been able to find, but there's like a dinner scene and there's a butler with his back to like the VHS box, and he's got white gloves, he's got holding like a tray in one hand. And behind his back, he's got a bloody fork, like a bloody meat fork. Ooh. He's holding with his white gloved hand, and the fork's got like blood dripping on it. And I'll never be able to find this movie. But
it's not
this
eating
is,
Raul?
It is not. I thought okay, that too, okay, but okay. No. This is a much, much worse movie that I remember. That I don't remember if I ever rented it, but I'm sure I might have at some point. But yeah, I first saw this movie through that video box, and then it showed up on probably premium cable, probably Showtime. It did the rounds on Showtime, mm-hmm. where I saw it every time it was on. And yeah, one of the first non-American Ninja movies I've talked to Jay about doing on the podcast really early on was this one. So like, this is like literally almost, how long have we been doing this?
Oh, you've been on the show for almost 10 years. So yeah, it's, yeah.
So this is at least 9.5 years in the making.
Yeah. So, I can thank Tobe Hooper for me seeing this movie. And it's because I saw Tobe Hooper's Invaders from Mars with my dad. And I loved that. And he loved it too, because it was a send up of all the stuff he grew up on in the 50s and early 60s.
Stay tuned on that one too.
Yeah. Oh, big time. Yes. We're definitely coming back to that, because Karen Black was an early crush for Jay. But anyway, we'll talk about that another day. But anyway, so I saw that, and I think we went and saw it in the theater, and we had a good time with it. And then rolling through the video store, he said that to the guy, the now famous Hills Video that I've referenced so many times on the show. And the guy said, well, if you like that, you'd like this. And he pointed to Night of the Creeps, the box. And my dad said, okay, yeah, that looks cool. And at that point in life, I had seen enough of Halloween 3 that when I saw Tom Atkins, I was like, Dr. Chalice is a cop? And this was before I'd seen Lethal Weapon, and a couple of years later. But this introduced me to the world of Fred Dekker, and indirectly to the world of Shane Black, who, you know, that the Shane Black Christmas will happen someday as a part of this film strip lexicon.
Nice.
And that probably be more on brand for what we do. But yeah, I've seen this movie really young. I mean, it was probably late 86, early 87. I was 10, 11. And I remember it. I mean, I can quote it when I was watching it earlier today. I was like, I didn't even really need to rewatch this. I just, it was the one thing of it I didn't remember. And I'll talk about it when we get to it, but I've seen it so many times. And like you, Ron, I definitely taped it off of Showtime and wore that out at some point, and then, you know, have jumped into the digital age with it. And it wasn't until the digital age that I saw the restored ending, whatever. We'll talk about that.
When right.
But yeah. But so I knew the dog ending, forever. But I just remember watching this, you know, growing up different times, and always, you know, finding somebody new in it. Like it went from being Dr. Chalice to Rusty from European Vacation.
Yes.
And to being, wait a minute, isn't that guy on Mama's Family? And he's such a douche now. And so, you know, and all that stuff, and all these people in it. And, it's just been one that I've loved. And if you are a patron of Tis the Podcast, and you've heard me and Ron on that, one of their early October Patreon shows, we talked about favorite horror movie moments. And one of mine is when Detective Cameron says, well, good news, girls, your dates are here. The bad news is the dead. and so I love this movie unabashedly. And, it's just one of those things. It's just a part of my childhood as much as anything else is. And like you, Linz, this is just, it has all the stuff I want from like a totally 80s movie. And what I think is funny is that the 80s have come back around now again for the new generation, because we've got a movie called Totally Killer, which I don't know if y'all have seen that yet or not on Prime, but two thumbs up. It's a fun ride, but it's definitely like a different take on the 80s. And I made a joke to a friend of mine that said, you know, get you somebody in your life that loves you the way the 1980s loved the 1950s and the way the kids today love the 1980s.
For real.
Yeah. It's a very interesting look at like decades and stuff. But,
sorry to interrupt, but like, speaking of like early childhood crushes, Jill Whitlow.
Oh, I mean, right. Could you not? Right.
I mean, yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. Sorry. I had to.
It's okay. Cause this is what I thought college was supposed to be like this, and back to school warped what exactly. I thought college was supposed to be.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. Was I disappointed.
This movie was Triple devoid of Oingo Boingo. And yeah. I'm a little disappointed.
That is true. Yeah, but
that would have made it. Can you imagine?
They could not have afforded party? That, but the needle drops in this movie are still very special. It's I'm with you. If we'd had a little Dead Man's Party, that would have been
perfect. Yeah.
Because that does come at like the most perfect time. So, but I mean, you've almost got it though, right? Because Steve Marshall is kind of like a seriously low rent Robert Downey Jr., at least from the 80s, you know, playing JC. Yeah.
Jay, you're stepping on my plot summary.
I did not know that.
Maybe we should launch into that first.
Liz, I'm with you. Yes, Ron.
Right, I derailed this. I'm sorry.
Go with it, please. Yes, give us a plot summary.
Hey, kids, have you ever seen a bee movie? Have you ever seen all the bee movies? If not, then don't worry. Night of the Creeps is the movie for you. We open in a spaceship where a goofy-looking Charles Band alien puppet is fleeing from two other goofy-looking alien puppets with a mysterious experiment in hand. That alien fires the experiment in the general direction of Earth, where it streaks over the campus of Corman University circa, I think, 1959.
Yep.
The cars? Huge. Gigantic. The student body? All white. The mental patients? Actively escaping even as we speak. Turns out, news bulletins about escape lunatics aren't the most romantic background for necking. I mean, at least not in 1959. Come back in 1989 and we can have a different talk. But that forces a young couple to leave their usual spot at Unplanned Pregnancy Point and head in pursuit of the falling star that flew overhead. The greaser male partner heads off into the woods after the thing. Not the thing, but the thing he saw. While the girl falls afoul of the escaped, axe-wielding lunatic. He's still hacking her up when he's ambushed and killed by a young police officer named Cameron. Hold on to that name. Actually, hold on to every name in this movie, because every person is named after a different horror director. But Cameron is especially important. Smash cut to the mid-80s, hotter than a set of twin babies, and a Mercedes-Benz with the windows up, etc., etc. Chris Romero, pining over his lost love, is moping around looking like a homeless man's Anthony Michael Hall. Let's call him Anthony Michael Passageway. His best friend, JC, who we'll call Robert Woolite Jr. instead of Robert Downey Jr., tries to console him by putting the moves on the most beautiful fake Ally Sheedy at school, Cynthia. To get her attention properly, Chris decides to fall into the most obvious of 80s traps, their fraternity, and tries to join the evil Beta Epsilon organization. They can, or so they're told, for a price. That price is a pretty epic prank. They have to steal a corpse from the medical center and deposit it on the front steps of a rival frat. They tell us which frat, but I can't remember which one, so I'm just going to pretend it's Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. Or possibly Delta House. You take your pick. The two friends skulk around, finding a corpsicle all Walt Disney'd in a cryogenic tube. They pop the guy out, but as they're dragging Frosty the Greaser Snowman out of the lab, witches in moves. The two drop the corpse and flee, screaming into the night, leaving only their pride and twin trails of urine behind them. The rapidly throwing corpse is now not just twitching, but moving. He's not just moving. He's killing, as a hapless Harold Ramis lookalike finds out firsthand. The cops hit the scene, and a grizzled film noir detective type named Cameron suspects that the axe murderer he may or may not have killed so long ago is back on the prowl. But actually, it's one of the murderer's victims from the 50s, who walks back to the sorority house with his half-frozen junk flapping around. His head explodes in a rain of slugs, a pretty good guar song that hasn't been written yet, if I do say so myself, and that's how Cameron and company find him. His head all be splayed out and his ass out for the world to see.
Also like a gore concert.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Have you ever made a guar reference on this podcast before? I feel like I would have remembered it if you had.
It was before your time, but yes, he has.
Of course I've made a guar reference. I've only seen him like four times.
That's anyway, fantastic.
Speaking of my dumb references, the frat blames this errant corpsing on JC and Chris, who are also taken in for questioning by the police for the very same crime. They're cowards, and a Japanese stereotype janitor confirms this, screaming like banshees. But their actions in freeing the rockabilly slime ball from the 50s start to have more repercussions than just, you know, trouble with the frat bros.
Rockabilly slime ball? I didn't know Chris Isaac was in this movie.
Yeah, Chris Isaac, or possibly leaving from
leaving.
But that's starting to have repercussions because people are starting to die with their heads exploded and lots of slugs are crawling around into people's brains. Which is an idea James Gunn says he didn't steal for Slither, but let's be honest, James Gunn, it's okay. You can admit it. Only Cynthia knows the truth, not about James Gunn, but about what's going on with the slug thing. And she trades a little cuddle time with Chris for his support in her crazy story. JC leaves the two to canoodle and heads to the bathroom, only to be accosted by the slugs from the head of the now dead janitor. Detective Cameron finds Chris, and the two go to the detective's bachelor pad to drink brown party liquor and trade stories. Chris talks about the zombies, and Cameron explains that the dead guy was one of the victims of the axe murderer he killed and buried under the sorority house as revenge for him turning his ex-girlfriend into Hamburger Helper. If you don't know by now that the corpse of the axe murderer is going to get a brain slug and a new lease on life, you're clearly not old enough to watch this movie. And if you don't think Cameron is going to roll up to the sorority house and blow that zombie's head into a big pile of slugs and paste, you've not been paying attention to what kind of flick this is. Kind of like how these kids haven't been paying attention to all the death around them and decide to go ahead with their fall formal dance, which is literally one of the like most useless things to happen in college. But that's a separate story. While getting properly suited and booted, Chris finds a message left for him by JC, in which his friend talks about the brain slugs in his brain, how he can kill said brain slugs, and that he loves Chris and wishes him the best in getting to first base or further with Cynthia. Chris immediately seeks out Cameron, who puts his suicide attempt on hold to go get a flamethrower from Dick Miller and head to the sorority. Good news? Most of the girls haven't been turned into monsters. That's pretty cool. Bad news? The Beta House party bus has crashed, and all the frat bros have been turned into the walking parasitic dead. Cynthia and Chris take out the zombies on the front lawn, while Cameron takes out the zombies and get into the rest of the house. But slugs keep getting away from the flamethrower or from the detective's gun, and they end up crawling under the sorority house into the basement, where one of the girls has been storing brains for a science experiment. Or just trying to feed her pet Tarman. Either way, there's lots of brains down there, and so slugs love them some brains. Cameron takes matters into his own hands, heading down into the basement with a can of gasoline, some duct tape for his mouth, and a lighter. After a brief argument, Chris and Cynthia head for safety, and Cameron opens up a gas valve. Cameron sparks up one last cigarette, and the sorority house goes up in flames. Chris and Cynthia share a kiss as they watch the house burn in true Fight Club fashion. We also know you saw this movie, David Fincher. A charred up, smoking Cameron, he's both smoking from the fire and smoking a cigarette, stumbles away from the scene of the explosion. Abruptly, the detective stops and collapses, probably because he's been burned to death. His head explodes upon hitting the ground, and slugs from inside his brain slither towards the Return of the Living Dead Memorial Cemetery. Overhead, searchlights from the Charles Band UFO appear in the night sky as the aliens from the opening sequence have returned, critter style, to retrieve their experiments. Yes. But it's already too late. As credits roll.
Oh, bravo, sir, bravo. That may be my favorite of your plot summaries. Well done. That was epic. Oh, man, so much to get into.
I'm so excited.
I know. So let's just talk about the whole black and white opening here and the way that they talk about economy of storytelling. You know, in 5 minutes, you get the entire layout of everything you need to know about Cameron, about what happened. You don't need a scientist on a board. You don't need Charlie Day with a bunch of damn yarn. You didn't know that. You know, you just have like a couple of scenes and like the old urban legend thing of like the axe murderer coming to you on Lover's Lane, or what did you call it, Ron? The unexpected pregnancy hill.
Yeah, unplanned pregnancy point.
Yeah,
point is spelled POINTE. FYI.
Of course. Yeah.
Right next to Cherry Falls, right? That's, if anybody's seen that one, but yeah, I love the way this all lays out and plays. Because again, it doesn't waste a lot of time, throws you right in, you know exactly what kind of movie you're down for. And the way it smash cuts from the 50s to the 80s is it's genius. I mean, I was like, man, this is awesome.
I liked the smash cut. It did. It smashed and cut right into it. I don't know what else to say about it, but the 50s black and white bits. When I first, and keep in mind, this is my first viewing, and I'm used to the other stuff that we review on this podcast. And so my first thought was, wow, this acting's pretty good. This is better than I was expecting.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, and
this
didn't
is
he want
better
to shoot,
than
like,
I was expecting.
Didn't he want to do like the whole thing in black and white originally? Wasn't that part of his plan?
Yeah, that was part of the deal, but the studio was like, no. Like, TriStar was like, no, no.
I think it might have actually been better if it had been all black and white, but
like if it had real money, it would be great if Cameron was always black and white because he's kind of living in 1959 permanently.
Yeah, he's got that 50s car that he's still driving.
Yeah, well, his whole apartment's 50s. Like, he's definitely stuck in the 50s. His lingo's
he's that 50s. Like classic American jock that can't get past, you know, his high school football team. You know,
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And didn't get past the high school sweetheart, you know. So.
Apparently, yeah. We even get a whole dream sequence about it.
Mm-hmm. It kind of looks like, and I may be wrong on this, it kind of looks like, is he driving around in a Hudson Hornet?
I think it might be, so.
Because it looks, they don't get a good enough shot of the front end for it for me. Mm-hmm. Or if they did, I didn't pay enough attention, but it kind of looks a little Hudson Hornet-ish. But
again, he's from like a different kind of life and movie. He's from the noir detective gumshoe, you know, down on his luck.
He's from Lethal Weapon.
He's from a B movie in the original sense of the word, but it was like a cheap poverty row gangster movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even references too. That's what I love about this. I'm like, okay, so Kevin Williamson also owes his entire life and career to this movie because he ripped off that whole aesthetic from this.
Well, and that was one of Fred Decker's big goals. Was he?
Right.
He was like, I'm going to reference every B movie cliche I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Hence all the every name being something, you know, B movie B movie director ish. All of the plots and subplots. I mean, they hit every note of a B movie and they start in the very opening of it. The fact that it's even set on a college campus makes you think of those cheapy, sub Porky's college sex comedies that came out in the 80s.
Yes. Right.
No stone was unturned in this thing. Like,
right.
It's really an impressive feat of writing to think of so many ways to just, oh, I could reference that. I could reference this. Mm-hmm. Let's cram this in there and let's throw everything from, you know, everything I can think of into one movie and just mash it all together with this Tom Atkins tomato.
How rad
sauce,
would it have like been if like Scott Baio had his powers from like Zapped and was just trying to fight the brain slugs, you know? I was trying to explain this movie to a friend of mine today, because I was saying, yeah, I'm gonna be on the show tonight. And so I told her what the movie was, and she was like, what is that? So I showed her the trailer. But before I did, I was like, yeah, it's like space alien brain slug meets kind of Revenge of the Nerds, you know, like they just mash them together and then, you know, throw in like Plan 9 from Outer Space, and you pretty much got it. So I showed her the trailer, and she like, it's like, I need to watch this movie now. Mm-hmm. Of course, we were at work, so like we couldn't, but I was like, yeah, as soon as you get home, like rent this thing because it's awesome. It's just everything you want it to be.
Yeah, there's nothing that this misses on. The thing about a script like that and with a goal like that is that you can do that and overdo it too, and it'll wreck it. You know, like you've seen that happen, right? So we can think about 100 different examples of that. But to definitely make it work along the way takes a very special touch. And I think the thing that gets me is, and Lindsay, you talked about the acting. Every single person in this movie clearly understood exactly what kind of movie they were in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they understood the assignment. Yeah.
Yeah.
They 100% did.
Even like the distribution company understood the assignment, because when they put this out in the Philippines, they gave out a gimmick for the moviegoers to have. They gave out sticker Night of the Creeps stickers that for them to put over their mouths to keep the brainworms out.
See, that's perfect. That's awesome.
Which is the most perfect 1950s movie touch that you could have put in this movie. And the fact they didn't do that in the United States, although they did release this movie under multiple titles in the United States, which is another great 1950s gimmick that needs to come back.
Yeah. Didn't work the first time. Try a second one.
That's right. Yeah, looking at you, chopping mall.
In like Cincinnati, specifically, it was one of the places that's mentioned. This movie was released under the title Homecoming Night. Night of the Creeps, which was used in like New York and L.A. So just, you know, they're keeping all the B-movie things alive.
Mm-hmm. Like that's hilarious.
It's amazing.
So they ran their own little A/B test.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Nice. Nice.
I wanted to talk about the acting real quick again. Everyone did a great idea, or everyone did a great job. They did understand the assignment. They all seemed to be acting in a slightly different style, though. It was almost like each one was cast in their own individual movie, mm-hmm. and they were each acting for that movie. And somehow it worked. Yeah. It's jarring at first, but it worked, and it was so entertaining for me to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Tom Atkins as the gumshoe detective guy.
Right.
Yep.
You've got JC, who's like the fast-talking, wise guy. Fast-talking,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've got the damsel in distress from really the 70s, Jill Whitlow, mm-hmm. and like her whole thing. And then you've got Chris, who's like from a John Cusack movie, you know, or
right.
something.
Right, yeah, you know, like legit, yeah.
And then you've got the fake Billy Zabka playing Brad from Mama's Family.
But even the bit parts.
Yeah.
Really went hard. The coroner?
Yeah, the coroner and his friends.
He's in
like
two lines every time.
David Paymer's in here as well.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he has like a moment coming through. It's unreal. Like the people you see that you would see for decades after, but mm-hmm. here they were just nothing, you know, just doing a bit part.
Like the janitor in this movie is 100% stolen out of one of those racist parts, subplots of a John Hughes movie.
Yeah, he has one line, you know, screaming like banshees, you know. It's a joke, you know, it's, and by the way, how is Screaming Like Banshees not a damn pop punk band right now? And when are we starting? Because I feel like that could happen.
I feel like that's the t-shirt. You guys should design it and sell the t-shirt.
Screaming like banshees on filmstrippodcast.com.
That's right.
Yeah. But I mean, really, but no, I like everything about all of that. Like the janitor could have been from two things. He could have been from like the, you know, typical white John Hughes high school, right? Or he's also like one of the Japanese like military survivors from the Red Scare movies, you know, like them and the Blob and all that stuff. You know, he's part of that too. And I thought that was fun. And he's playing up all that. And he could also be an extra in a Beetlejuice movie because he kind of was wearing the same dungarees.
And I thought he could be like, did you ever see that movie? I think it's Michael Keaton, where his auto company is taking
Gung-Ho.
Over.
Gung-Ho, yes.
He could have been in Gung-Ho, too, because it was that kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I love Gung-Ho. That's another one I've seen like a bazillion times.
I saw Gung-Ho in theaters.
Nice.
Yeah, too bad it's not at Christmas. We have no excuse to talk about it because it's otherwise kind of worthless as a movie. But
even... Even like, yeah, even like the sorority, individual sorority mm-hmm. girls are in different movies.
Oh, they're all from like prom night and Black Christmas. Mm-hmm. Like
you've got like the one girl who's like reading and doing studying. She's very clearly coded to be like the prom night type girl. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say Cynthia is more of the Ellen Ripley from Alien type.
Yeah, she's pretty tough. I mean,
after she gets over that, she becomes like she's running around with a flamethrower. That's
Well, I mean, she does the roll up flip off to her boyfriend, you know, and I mean that's pretty awesome in front of like his whole fraternity. I mean, that was badass,
and everybody clapped.
I know, right? Like a round of applause. So, mm-hmm.
That's what they did before social media, kids.
See, yes, they
clapped for breakups.
Everybody shamed you in public in front of you.
So, I mean, if I had a nickel, right?
I loved how like when he calls her later too and then is trying to talk to her and lay some of this, what I get for dating a friggin' psych major or whatever, and she just hangs up on him. I'm like, it's all, that's the trope too, the psych major, you know. It's always the psych major, you know. So when all the psych majors I knew in college, like, they were like the smart ones, like you wanted to be friends with them, they would get you through on a rough night of studying. But yeah, I
was a psych major as
see
well,
there, you
major.
There you go, there you go.
We've come full circle here, y'all. So.
Yeah, twice the work, half the pay. It was great.
we got to talk about Chris and JC's whole dynamic, though, and the fact that we have a character who is on crutches. So he's clearly like he's got polio or something like that. They never really call it out, and the fact that they don't call it out is what is so amazing. I'm like, well, now like there would be like a whole like 30 minutes to that and his whole story, but it's just right. Who he is. Like, and I kind of, I don't know. There was something about that that I was like, he's just who he is. And nobody says anything about it. Like the jerk trips him, of course, cause he's an asshole, right. But right. He would have done it anyway if he was just walking like Ralph Macchio or something in Karate Kid. Mm-hmm.
And I think Fred Decker even said that was just like a holdover from like something previously he had written, and he just had that. And so he just kind of threw it in there. He just thought it was cool and different. So it was cool. You didn't see a lot of that at that time at all. So just the fact that it's in there is like significant, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It's like they just spent zero time on it, and it doesn't really make sense, but it works.
Well, that's what makes it good though. I say is that they don't spend any time on it, and you realize these guys have history together, and you don't know all of it, and you don't need to hear all of it, but when they're having their little spat in the dorm room, that was friggin' hilarious. Well, F you too. We done? Yeah, we're good. Throw me a pillow. You know? But I don't
know. F you wish.
Yeah, you wish. You would.
Your mom. Let me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was just waiting for that to happen. But it's what makes it so like, there's something about this movie, and movies of this era all have this, like we talked about Invaders from Mars, this movie, you dropped the original Critters, Ron, that's in the archives. You can hear me and Nick talking about that. There's something about these movies, and even something like My Science Project, where everybody in it is very lived in, and we're just sort of dropping in on like a very specific moment.
Right.
And it's okay that's all we get. I don't know. There's something about that. I don't think it's done anymore in storytelling these days, but I particularly liked it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, it's great to have history. And you're right. Like, especially you think of like all these Christopher Nolan films and just every, you know, all these big blockbusters, and none of them feel as like already character heavy as these are. As soon as you get in there, you know, you're kind of building that character as you go through the movie. And these guys are already like out of the gate. You know, we see it.
I can think of one movie in the last 5 years that I feel like has done that. And it was the Prey Predator prequel that they throughout on Hulu. Like everybody in that, like there was clearly a lot of history there that we didn't get to hear, and that was okay. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that worked on that level. But yeah, it's not something you see much anymore. But Chris and JC, those very specifically, have an interesting connection with each other and stuff like that. So I'm just gonna ask it right now. Is JC like in love with Chris, or is he just like, that's his bro for life? Cause I can go either way with it, and I don't care. I'm just saying like, it plays a lot of different ways when you watch it.
That's interesting. That's a good question. I think it's just his bro, but I think it can be interpreted the other way. And I think that's okay too. I don't think that's like a wrong reading. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of vague in that way, but I always got the sense they were just like, you know, like Frodo and Sam and just like best buds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, they are like Frodo and Sam.
That's a good call. I hadn't thought about that, Jerry. So, yeah, by the way, we will eventually get to Lord of the Rings before you've been on the show for 10 years, Lindsay, I promise. But
it's okay. I mean, it won't stop me from watching it.
That's right.
All the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the reason I read it though is because you talked about that coroner earlier. When he can't remember the code to the door, he calls somebody back home, and he's clearly talking to another guy. You hear kind of a muffle, and that's very coded as if they were a couple. And so I felt like Fred Decker was just sort of just lacing that through there. Like, not that he's had this agenda or whatever, but it's just like, I'm just going to make this play as normal as this kid on crutches hanging out with the redheaded ginger frat wannabe guy. Like, we're just going to play it all straight. And I don't know. I thought it was kind of neat.
Yeah. Yeah.
How awesome would it have been if they had tried to rush with like the Tri-Lambs? That would have been like so perfect.
Right? Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and Lamar and Lewis just hanging out.
I feel like either reading is perfectly valid. And I think Fred Decker would be fine with either reading, because it feels like, you know, it feels very much like the kind of thing that he would be like, oh, that's a great idea. I wish I'd thought of it that way when I was doing it.
Exactly. <know? laughs> Yeah.
Or, you know, that's a great idea. That was definitely what I was thinking about. Wink, wink.
Yeah. I mean, it plays either way. And I think that's one of the strengths of the simplicity of the movies, that you can just go with it. However, but either way, I once declared that, the greatest horror movie girlfriend of all time was the brunette in Friday the 13th 3, because she's pregnant, but she lets her boyfriend like walk on his hands and do juggling and smoke weed. And, you know, she wants to have sex in the hammock, and what, she's the greatest horror girlfriend ever before she gets chopped in half by Jason. And I'm going to say in horror movie parlance, JC is the best wingman of all time. Like, no doubt. Like he will ride or die to the end. He is the goose to Chris's Maverick all the way.
Well, yeah, when you've got that Robert Woolock Jr. charisma, you better make some use of it.
Wait, you know what, though, man? You saying that and making that joke, like, I had not put it together, but he very much is, it feels very much like the Robert Downey Jr. character in Back to School.
It really does. And the whole time, I kept thinking that he reminded me of someone. And same, Jay, when Ron mentioned Robert Downey Jr.,
yeah,
everything just clicked.
Yeah.
This was the first time that I've watched this movie where that just hit me square in the face. Like, oh, he's doing Robert Downey Jr. in Back to School, and they're doing the same thing in this movie with him.
Now I want a movie with both of them. Like,
yeah, right.
That would be awesome.
I think Keith Gordon's got a little bit more going on than Jason Lively, but you know, those two are pretty much the same. So except Jason Love is maybe a foot taller. So he's a tall, lanky guy. But I think the other thing that was trying to, like, my older brother, he's not taller than me, but he is a ginger. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one that I knew growing up, you know. Mm-hmm. So he always stuck out in his group of friends, you know, all the dark-headed kids, you know, the blondes and stuff. And so I think that's the other reason, like, Jason Lively, I always remember his face because he looked a little bit like my brother did when he was in high school. And it was around the same age. They're the same age. So it's, I don't know, there's something about that. But I'd love their whole dynamic and the whole thing. And the, like, all the sisters in the sorority, again, none of them really get much of a story, except that there's enough Aquanet going on there that flamethrower goes off. There's a lot more going down in the house.
Yeah. But yeah, that house would have exploded way before the gas on.
We were not caring about the ozone back then, kids. But what's awesome is the girl just randomly, like, I'm just going to keep some brains in the cellar. It's just for science experiment. Don't tell, you know, Jessica. She'll
don't
lose
worry
your
mind. About it.
Yeah. It's like, you know, like, well, that's going to end badly for everybody. But that's, I think, to what you alluded to, Ron, that's the joke, right? It's like, obviously, it's always going to be something like that.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
My
right.
roommate in college was a biology major, and we never had brain in our apartment, but we had some really weird, questionable things that was growing in that dorm room and apartment. We lived together all 4 years. So, I believe the brain thing. That's totally a thing. That's definitely out. A project.
That yeah.
yeah, that definitely checks out.
Can we talk about Huntsacker? What Huntsacker? Cameron's. sorry, Cameron's like one-liners.
Oh, you know, yes,
thrill
yes.
me and Zingers. What did they say? Like Miller time.
Yeah, hi, oh, Spanky. Gosh.
Spanky. You know? I mean, yeah, so just like it's amazing.
Tom Atkins looked like he is having a blast doing this. And every interview I've ever seen of him talking about it, he said, like, oh, I love this. Fred and I go way back. He said, Shane Black's in this movie too. He's one of the cops. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's all these people from that era of Hollywood just bumming around, hanging around together. And he said he loved it. Yeah, I think you're right, Jerry. He said before it was one of his favorite things he ever did. So.
He had so many great one-liners, and he just attacked them. He attacked every line that he had.
And according to him and Fred Decker, that's all Fred Decker. Yeah, Tom Atkins says, everybody likes to think I come up with that. Nope, I just read the words, kids. It's called acting. So I think it's exactly how he said it. But you think about Tom Atkins' horror cred, though. Like, the different people he's played, like the Fog guy is way different than Dr. Chalice in Halloween 3. He's way different than Cameron here and any of the things he's done. Like, he's a really versatile actor.
Yeah, and he's way different from Captain Ream and Escape from New York, which is where I first.
Oh yeah,
got my.
Yeah, that's right.
My
Atkins, exposure to him.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Agenshine. So
and then Maniac Cop.
Yes.
Oh, he was in Maniac. Yes, that's another good one.
And to tie this back to our video store memories, he was Detective McCleary in George Romero's 2000 flick Bruiser.
Which oh, I forgot came out about
when
that.
Which came out when I worked in a video store.
Nice. Okay, so it's Halloween confessional time. I've seen a lot of George Romero movies. You know one I've never actually seen? top to bottom, Night of the Living Dead.
Really?
What?
No, never wow. saw the whole thing. I will finish that. If you follow me on Blue Sky or Twitter right now, I'm doing my 31 days of horror where I'm trying to watch something new to me, you know, at least every day, or I watch a couple in a day and put them out. But that one's on my list to like knock down before October 31st. I've never seen it top to bottom. I know what it's about and I've seen the remakes, but never seen the original, the 68. So.
Wouldn't have guessed that.
That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. Zombies and werewolves. It's a big hole in my horror lexicon.
Oh, as, man.
As we've well established. You know?
Silver Bullet, The Howling. Those are all like some of my favorites.
I would refer people to a couple of weeks ago to Ginger Snaps because we had a good time doing that. So, I think nice. Ginger Snaps 2 is going to have to make an appearance sometime in the future, too, y'all. That was, I watched that. That was too
what's
good.
What's the one where, I'm sorry to derail, I know we're, but the one where the kid turns out to be, he was like adopted by two vampires and then turns out he's like a werewolf. It was like a bunch of shorts. It's like a movie with like a bunch of different, like three or four different shorts in it.
Twilight? <I can't>...
Teen Wolf 2?
No, I'll remember it later.
Yeah, I want to find that. Yeah, I don't know that one. So horror anthology was a big part of this. That's another thing. This
are
feels
you
like
talking about the, was that a Tales from the Crypt episode by any chance?
Maybe that's what it was, but I think there was a movie with it too as well. But I think you're right. It might have been a Tales from the Crypt episode, maybe.
I mean, real. Some of those Tales
now, from the Crypt episodes
were movies that just didn't have theatrical link sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Some of those were pretty solid. Except when Jennifer Grey has to go to the Bahamas or what the hell ever with that voodoo shit. That was weird. anyway, so we as we digress, but no, everybody here, like I say, is from a different thing. And what I love is that Cameron, the way he goes about doing things and, you know, his partner, when they pick the boys up the next day after all this shenanigans at the morgue and everything's going on and they're doing the interrogation. He's doing like the classic, like he's the good cop and the bad cop at the same time, which is funny. And so it's very tropey, but it almost felt like the very end of Psycho where the psychiatrist shows up to like explain to you what the movie was or whatever. And I was like, oh, I don't know if that's what he's trying to reference, but it feels very much the same way. It's like, you're testifying for the witnesses, detective, but thank you very much. So it was a good time. So I enjoyed that. It was kind of fun.
If I remember correctly, that guy, the partner, was also in Escape from New York as one of the like background cops.
Yeah, he looked familiar. I don't know the actor, but I know the face and the voice in particular.
He was definitely in The Golden Child. I can tell you that much for sure.
Yeah. He was.
I love The Golden Child.
My dear brother Noomsi.
It's another one that doesn't get a lot of play anymore.
No, it doesn't. That deserves a shot. That one.
My brother has forgiven me.
Yes. I want the knife.
That's right.
Yeah. So, that's one of Eddie's less remembered ones, but it's worth a revisit. Watched it not all that long ago, and it's, well, I mean, hell, Charles Dance is the freaking Satan in the movie. Come on.
That's like how I first learned of Charles Dance from that.
Yeah, every time I've seen him since, I'm like, well, it's my dear brother Noomsi.
So, yeah, that's right.
Cutting open a deer, cursing out his son for screwing his sister, what the hell ever on Game of Thrones. But blur alert. But anyway, so no, I love all of that stuff. And we got to talk about the slugs here, though. And the space slug situation. So, Ron, you described it real well as like a Charles Band kind of thing. And it reminded me like, oh, yeah, the beginning of Critters is like this, too. Or like there's this intergalactic space war happening. You don't know why.
Right.
And it hit me that the brothers Strauss, they got saddled to make Alien versus Predator Requiem, decided, hell, we'll just make a serious version of Critters in this. And that's pretty much what it is. The same trope. And I had never thought of that, but what the hell is going on with the flesh? It looks like one of those little wrestler figures used to drop in water and it would go 10 sizes too big, you know, the little plastic man.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a B movie thing they needed to cram into this flick. You know, if it's good enough for this movie and it's good enough for Laser Blast, you may as well just roll with it. Except the aliens in Laser Blast somehow look even worse than these, I guess, because they had even less money to make that flick. But
well, these actually had some animatronics in that head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those, the laser blast ones were just little people in alien suits that had huge butts for some reason.
Was this Claudio Fragasso's first movie before Troll 2? That's what it sounds like.
He probably guest directed that. But no, this whole thing feels
second
like
unit.
Like this whole thing feels 100% like it's got ripped out of a Charles Band. Like they found that in Charles Band's notebook and they're like, say,
that's not me. Bad. Let's do that.
Yeah. But it just goes back to the whole, you know, got to cram in every B movie trope. So you may as well throw some aliens in there.
So are the space slugs like a weapon or are they like
an experiment?
That's the experiment.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. The experiment. Okay.
Now, I'm not sure why one of the aliens decided to jettison it, or was he trying to hide it?
Allegedly, he's possessed by the space slugs.
Oh.
Oh.
See
that's that? That's not in the text. That's in the Wikipedia article.
I mean that they could have visually shown that because it's very clear when somebody's space slugging.
I wonder if it's like in the novelization. Yeah. Is there a novelization?
Is there a novelization? Oh, there is. That needs to happen.
I feel like there needs to be now.
That's going
to
go on my Amazon.
Can I write it? I want to write it.
Right? I would recommend that and the Jaws the Revenge novelization as a twofer. Like that's your beach read next summer.
Okay, so there is a novelization. It is on Thrift Books right now. Yeah, I hit the Google machine right away. And you can get it in acceptable condition for like $8 and something.
That's sold. Well, that's happening.
Take my money.
Yes.
And I'm here like, that's too rich for my blood.
eight whole dollars?
$8.
In 1986 money, we're talking some serious dough now. But,
that's right.
Inflation sucks. It's like a gallon and a half of gas now. So.
For real.
I love that, the way the slugs make their moves and they just turn into like reanimation hell. You know, everybody becomes a zombie, right?
Right.
But it's fun to watch like the makeup job on these is stellar. Like it really, mm-hmm. for as cheap a movie as this is, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I completely agree. And the whole makeup crew had like complete freedom to do whatever. There was like a pretty small crew from what I understand. And they just like, he was like, all right, go do it. And he kind of approved it and then told them to save time. Like, work, you know, just be in the movie, work on yourselves, make your own casts. Well, and
you know who did the special effects? Robert Kurtzman and Howard Berger.
No, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did not know that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You can see them later. They're two of the beta guys when they're right. Zombified. Yeah.
Yeah. All those guys are the actual effects guys.
I don't know what Greg Nicotero was doing at this time, but hopefully it was something good because he missed out. They should have had the trifecta, all three of them in the same.
Oh man,
that's okay.
One of my favorites. I love the makeup was cool all around, mm-hmm. and you can tell that they had a ton of fun with it.
Right.
There was one of the cadavers that was walking around the morgue had the what do you call them? The scissors. They're not.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was clamps.
David Paymer.
Yeah. They had the forceps or the sutures like hanging off of his clavicle, basically with the skin on it, and it just looked peeled back. It was such a cool effect.
Yeah, wasn't really, that David Paymer?
I think it was. Yeah. Yeah. It was him. Yeah. Yeah. No, that all looked great. And
who I mostly know from No Holds Barred, of course.
I mean, how would you not?
That's right. Yeah.
So, I'll tell you what, brother. I won't be here when these slugs cash.
Can you imagine Hulk Hogan in this movie?
Oh.
I would love to dreamcast this movie using Hulk only Hogan. WWE wrestlers.
Hulk Hogan as Detective like Ray Roddy Piper.
Well, I'll tell you, brother. Would have to be the hero here, right? I mean, like in They Live?
Yes, of course.
He's got to be. Got to be Roddy Piper.
That's hilarious.
Would you go for the obvious and have Hulk Hogan be Detective Cameron, or would you go for like somebody like, say, classy Freddie Blassie?
No, I think you got to have Hogan as Cameron because Macho Man's got to be Brad. And I wanted to talk about Brad though, because the makeup job they do with him when he zombified stumbles over to the house and Cynthia's looking down, she grabs his little hand and walks out there to break it with him, and slugs just fall out while she's breaking it. It was such great comedy.
It was so good.
This is great physical comedy. And I was just like, oh, that was awesome. She's like, you know, we're just growing apart. She's trying to play that so sincere.
It's really hard for me. Yeah.
Sitting there just falling apart behind her. It's hilarious. It's very Return of the Living Dead kind of humor, Ron, you know, with just people are just falling apart. Thriller, you know, people are just falling apart behind you, you know. I think there's a joke in Thriller where one of the zombies is doing the little twitch and his arm just falls off because it was like a mistake and the dancer just kept going and they kept it, you know. Because he was just into it, and but I love that. I thought that was so funny because it brings up, you know, the point. And then of course I love how Cameron, like, it's the most dramatic retelling of his basically life story you could ever get. I mean, he's you want to know what happened next, Spanky? No, I really do not.
No.
I don't. Yeah. I'm going to tell you anyway. He just keeps going. And I was worried for Chris. I'm like, man, Cameron's drinking pretty hard. Like, this is going to go bad.
That whole scene was set up as that whole scene was set up like a
date rape.
I wasn't going to go there.
I thought you were. That's why I was like,
oh, no, you beat me to it. No, I was going to say the whole thing is set up like one of those like suspense movies. It's almost like a Deliverance or one of those like 70s style, I'm gonna tell you all about what's gonna happen.
Oh, it's like the original Cape Fear. It's Robert Mitchum.
Yes. Oh, that's it, exactly.
Doing all that stuff. Yeah.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Yeah, it's and I love that though. That's what's great, because he's supposed to be the good guy, but he's got this dark past because he murdered a suspect, you know, and buried him under the house. And of course, that's where the house mother lives. And I'm like going, man, how are Billy and Alice not a part of this world too from Black Christmas? Because that's the crossover event we needed that we didn't get. Night of the Creeps means Black Christmas.
I want like every single college movie from like the 80s, you know, to be on this one campus, you know.
Right. They're all all in the same conference, at least. They're all in that same Midwestern
Something
situation going on there. You know, so yeah, that's because Green Lakes, where the back to the school situation is happening, is like just up the road a little bit, you know. It's the more
didn't they film that at Wisconsin?
They did. They filmed
that. I think they did. Yeah.
On campus.
But what would you name this conference of fictional universities? Like, what would that be?
Conference names don't matter anymore. No,
they really don't. But back in those days, they did. So it would be like the most white middle America thing I could think of. So I don't know, flour, Play-Doh, something.
Big Ten.
Big Ten. The Big Ten.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah,
I think you're onto something with that one, Lindsay. Yeah, think about that. I gotta say, man, the performance Steve Marshall gives through this movie is accentuated best, because we didn't even get to see his last moments on screen. You know, his whole bathroom scene that's intense and really good. And I do think when they made the movie Dreamcatcher off of that Stephen King book years later, they ripped that off.
They ripped it off.
They do rip that off. That, and I almost wonder if Stephen King didn't rip this off when he's writing the book, but because the play's the same, if you know what I'm talking
about.
Wasn't
he like so doped up at that time he doesn't even remember?
Dreamcatcher is what he wrote when he got out of the accident. So he was
right. So he was like on painkillers.
Yeah, he was
like
on painkillers the whole time. So that's why he wrote it, because he was supposed to be the guy that gets in the accident. That's him. But anyway, but yeah, I feel like it's the same thing. But I love his like going away tape. He leaves like a saw tape for Chris. Like, I want to play a game. Also, I have a space slug right now, so it's not going to go well for me. But I love how he like tells him all this stuff, and he like the way his voice is so dark and deep. It's a performance. So
how does he keep like his mental capacity?
Yeah.
That whole bathroom scene, though, if we could talk about that for a second, I loved that. It's probably my favorite scene in the whole movie for a couple of reasons. When we find out that the slugs burn up, that's, I don't know why he reached for the matches to begin with. I don't remember what he was trying to do there. But when the slug went up his pant leg, I audibly yelled. It was such a shock to me that that happened. I was expecting it to, you know, jump in his mouth like it did everything else. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. But the set dressing in the bathroom and all of the writing on the wall, and I don't know if you guys noticed this special little Easter egg, but as he's trying to get out of the bathroom, in big red letters, it says, "Go Monster Squad."
Yes, I did see
I did notice that.
Yep, yep.
I actually did the whole like 10-second backup, and I said, "Did that say what I think it said?"
Yeah, I did the same thing, yeah.
And Monster Squad might be one of my favorite Halloween movies.
A million
to watch.
Percent.
I love that movie so much. So
we need to do that one too.
Yeah. And this, I guess, was that movie in the works when this one was being released? Because Fred Decker
he was in talks to do it at that point. So
yeah.
But I think Shane was writing the script or doing the polish on it or whatever. But yeah,
the polish. Yeah, they co-wrote it. Yeah, I got to have Sean Robert on to talk about that one, and he was pretty instrumental in having that documentary Wolfman's Got Nards come out, and he apparently he would like every day write, you know, just like the kid, I can't remember his name now,
the Dear, you know, Army guys,
yeah, and he, right, and so he wrote to like the studios like that about re-releasing it and getting it
so
they have him on that special, and I got to talk with him. It was really cool. So if you guys do that, that would be amazing. So
we'll definitely bring you back on for that. So because that one's been on the list for a bit too. We need.
Yeah, we've talked about it a couple times. So
but it's been a minute since I revisited that one too. But I remember something my dad said to me when we were watching this, because I had the same question of like, how is he able to like be normal? Because everybody else is. My dad said, well, because he's got a handicap, he's like got more willpower than other people because he has to work harder at it. And I was like, what an 80s, like,
wow,
you know, Saturday afternoon special answer, Dad. That's, thanks. Also, yeah, that's not what you meant to do there, but okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I like it though. I mean, in some way, I'm like, you know, it's actually kind of neat, right, if you think about it like that. It's like, ah, yeah, sure. Yeah, why not? This guy's to overcome all kinds of shit. He can overcome some space slugs for 20 minutes. So,
well, and the thing is, he wasn't dead when he didn't die as a result of his being taken over.
Yeah, yeah. And he wasn't already dead. Yeah.
And also, it's heavily implied that the space slug had to go the long way. So
this is true. It was working its way through.
So maybe that's how.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, I love how he decides I'm going to take myself out by, you know, basically, you know, melting my face on the boiler. I was like, ouch. Ooh. Ow, man. What a way to go. But
yeah. Gruesome. Yeah.
But we talked about the makeup effects, but the actual horror effects, the physical, man, it's good. Like, it looks just as good as any slasher from the era. Like, the blood and guts is good.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Can we talk about how the space slugs sometimes are like slow, sometimes they're super fast, and sometimes they shoot out of people's mouths like a bullet, and other times, like with the boyfriend, you know, they're just kind of. Just
they're kind of like koi nice fish. Slow.
Like, there's no, yeah, there's no consistency. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Remind me never to build a back.
I know that. I will never look at my Chinese restaurant the same again.
Exactly.
So I have two koi fish, and one of them is big and slow, and she doesn't move a ton. And the other one is a tiny kind of baby. And
can I ask a serious question? Are you sure they're koi?
I have no idea. They were here. They were creeps here when we moved here.
So. They came with the house.
They're 1,000,000% creeps.
We're going to leave the wall to wall and the fish.
Yeah, they came. They definitely came with the house. But one of them's big and moves really slow. She doesn't like. I almost said slither, but she doesn't like sprint or whatever the swimming equivalent is for that. But the other one does. Right. He just whips right around that little pond all day long, just scooting around. So maybe they're all just different, like fish.
Yeah, I just took it like some of us are sprinters and some of us are built for distance.
That's true. You know? I was built for comfort.
It's just funny because like the dog, like out of the dog's mouth, it's just
yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
And then, yeah.
No,
the animal makeup, the puppets or whatever they used for those were really cool.
Oh, there's definitely some good puppet work, but I mean, it's like really good puppet work. Yeah.
With like the worm crawling out of its eye. And,
it's very, very good. Close to, it was only a year or two later, the original Pet Cemetery had some good dead animal situation going on in it, and very, very eerie the same way. So I love that when we decide we're going all in here, that we go shop at Dick Miller's Flamethrower Emporium at the cop store here. And then Tom Atkins is like, yeah, requisition form. Don't have one of those, as he loads his 12-gauge shotgun in front of the guy. And Dick Miller's just sitting there going like, this happened to my cousin. He had that store up in California. That guy came in, bought all the guns and shot him. It's the same thing. you ever want, I mean, he's gone now, but you wonder if anybody ever asked Dick Miller, like, you kind of played a guy behind a desk giving people weapons a lot. Like, it seemed to be your thing for a while, but no, I loved him.
He knows what he's good at.
No, it's just the one scene, but he's so good. You know, Jerry, we were talking about Gremlins, you know, he's such a memorable part of that. And he's so much fun in this too. Yeah. The look on his face is like, oh man, I'm gonna get chewed out for this, but whatever, Cameron. You know, it's not like the first time it's happened.
That's right.
And that's what I'm laughing about. I'm like, Cameron's definitely checked out like the M16 a couple times. And
well, and that's like such an 80s trope, because I just did Running Scared, and you know, same thing there where they like trick the guy into giving him like some of that coke, you know. So it's like the same thing. It's just such an 80s trope of like, it doesn't matter. The hero's somehow gonna bully his way into getting whatever he wants from evidence or in this case, requisitions, you know.
I like how you brought it up earlier, the run that Cynthia becomes Ellen Ripley, because she gets the flamethrower. Because you think Chris would have it, but he really sucks with it. Like, he's better with like the blunt instruments, you know. So maybe he's the lover, she's the fighter. We don't know. And so you know, Cynthia's out there just torching the world, and
it does make me wonder who the big spoon
is. I think we know that's it. I think that's clear.
She's also got some past trauma that she took out on that flamethrower.
There's some bad stuff going on there. If she didn't have money, she'd have been on the pole. Like, let's just say it.
But he's like yelling at her for like a long time before she finally.
I was going to ask you, like, it feels like there's two scenes put together there. There's the one where like she's in charge, and then this woman, he's having to convince her. And I'm like, did they like reverse that some way or something? Because it's a little different than I mean, it's a very different mode, because he goes from that to, you know, do it, you know, kind of crazy. It's almost like Nick Cage at the end of Firebirds,
right?
You know, where he goes from like, I've got him, I'm gonna kill him now.
Oh my god,
losing his shit like for no reason. So
now I want Nick Cage. Oh, in this movie,
how could he not have been Brad? He would have been awesome.
Like in an alternate universe, I want to see this.
Nick Cage and Hulk Hogan in Night of the Creeps.
And then Ogre just randomly.
That would be awesome. So get Larry B. Scott back here too. He could be JC. So in the ring. Wow. So when he's not making Iron Eagle 7 or whatever. I love how like she does go on the attack, and well, like you said, we get the return of the Living Dead guy, the axe murderer guy who still has on his I mean, I love how his like hospital issued garments haven't like deteriorated at all in 27 years.
Deteriorated,
yes,
yeah.
But not that I do love
polyester.
I killed you. Yeah, but
I was just about to say that, Lindsay. It's a testament to the power of polyester.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It can't stop. It can't stop an Ithaca 112, because when Cameron gets that out, he goes L.A. Confidential on that ass quick. It was on. So, but no, I love Cameron because he's firing off one-liners and the gun like every 2 seconds. It's hilarious. It's awesome. But they take out the big horde, and of course, we're going to get to the last stand. And I thought it was hilarious that not only did Tom Atkins go with the duct tape over the real mustache, but he's delivering line through the duct tape. I'm like,
like that's all ADR, right?
Oh, I mean, I'll be damn money for that. Because it sounds like somebody muffled through the duct tape. I thought it was great, man. I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, he totally like Loomis's himself.
Yes, he Loomis's himself in Halloween 2. Yes. Love that.
Yeah, it's just
but the only thing is that they gave Jason Lively his line. Like, go ahead, detective, thrill me. And he gives it with that much oomph. But I needed Cameron to light that cigarette up and go, thrill me, Sparky, or whatever. And then, you know, like, come on, Cameron.
That would have been,
I wanted him to have that line.
It's for Miller something, time, right? Something. Yeah.
When
those
he blows,
one-liners are key.
He blew that house to smithereens. I mean, that was another 80s trope, the house just exploding, you know, like cars and houses just explode randomly.
Same thing with Monster Squad when Dracula throws the dynamite.
Yep.
Well, houses were much less expensive back then.
This is true.
That's true.
It's like Time Bandits where you touch the evil and it just levels it. And Sean Connery walks by and winks at you. You know? but That's a stay tuned, by the way. I've been wanting to do that one for a long time. Mm. So that's a dark childhood memory. I saw that movie, I was blown away. No idea. But it went darkness. Whew. But no, I love
come
that.
For the B movie, stay for the dark childhood memories.
I mean, that's what we work out here at Film Strip. Welcome to Film Strip, the therapy session that we disguise as a podcast.
But, Aren't all podcasts
they are.
It's just going to be a Film Strip sessions, but therapy will be in parenthetical.
Parentheses, yes.
Exactly. We could have a whole therapy month. Ooh.
So, flamethrowers, cheaper than therapy. That's what she needs, that t-shirt.
I mean, that's a t-shirt. Cheaper than therapy is the opening act, though, for Screaming
so
Like Banshees.
For t-shirts.
Okay? It's Cheaper Than Therapy is the girl band that opens for Screaming Like Banshees.
That's right.
I've got it all worked out.
Cynthia really did look like she was enjoying genuinely using that flamethrower.
I think Cynthia had a
she
career.
She looked like a boss.
Yeah.
She looked like she'd done that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like maybe Brad took her to the gun range. Maybe dad was in the military. We don't know, you know. Maybe her uncle, you know, was, and her cousins out in California deal with a comet in a few months. You never know. They could all be from the same family.
I was thinking maybe her cousin is what's her name from Commando, the little girl?
Oh, Alyssa Milano.
Alyssa Milano.
Yeah, she's Jenny. Thinking of the character name, Jenny.
Yeah. She could be. I mean, you didn't Matrix. See Arnold in this movie.
I learned this from my Uncle John. John Matrix.
Yes. Also learned how to drive a truck without any power down a hill.
Not my other uncle, John Merrick. I didn't learn anything from him but how to make clothes out of bags.
Yeah, I miss my Uncle Vernon Wells. I used to call him Uncle Freddie Mercury because he wore chainmail.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I assume we all saw the same ending, the one Ron described with the spaceship over the end, because it wasn't until years later that I knew that was the restored ending, because I always remember the dog jumping into Cynthia's.
The dog. The dog
the
is
slug
one that I
jumps
know,
into
right.
Cynthia's mouth. So,
yeah, I don't know if you can get the original I don't know if you can get the original ending anymore, or if you are stuck quote unquote with the director's cut.
The clip's on YouTube, I know, but
yeah, you can find it on the interwebs, but
it's not on any of the rentals that I've seen. It's not the one I own, at least. So
does anybody have a strong preference for one ending over the other, aside from just the one you've seen the most?
No, I mean, if I really think about it, I think the alien one actually has a better symmetry. You know, it's almost like bookends, but I've seen the dog one more, so I kind of like that one better. So yeah,
well, I mean, the dog one's more realistic. It's like we've seen Jake bitten by the shark, we know he's dead ending, versus the happier ending where somehow they actually killed all the alien space slugs, you know. So I don't know. I kind of like the darker ending, but that's just a lot about
me. Well, the thing is, neither ending successfully killed the space slugs.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Right.
So that's right. Kind of the joke, right? It doesn't make any difference. Which maybe that's why I have such strong memories of this with Invaders from Mars, because of the way that movie ends too. It's like, oh shit! There's nothing you can do. You're trapped. It's like Groundhog Day, but with space slugs. So, and less Andy McDowell. But
oh man,
this just makes me wish that there was a sequel to this movie.
Yeah, you know, I know why there's not, because it didn't make any money. I mean, and nobody knew what to do with this, you know, and it, clearly, but it found its life on home video, and obviously Decker and everybody else kept working for years, so they didn't ding them for it. But it would be neat to see what they would do, like where you would go.
Are we counting Zombie Town?
Spiritual sequel?
I think actually in Germany it was released as Night of the Creeps 2, Zombie Town.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, you know, like...
Europe has different rules.
That's like Demolition Man being called like Rambo the Destroyer in like Beirut or something, you know, it does, or Kuwait. It doesn't really count, but...
Speaking of destroyers, Conan the Destroyer is another scene.
The hand-painted Tanzanian poster for Night of the Creeps is amazing.
Oh, you know.
Because it's going to be like Tom Atkins with a machine gun.
Yes.
I want Fred Decker to like make part two right now. And like bring back Jason Lively and all these...
Whitlow,
Jill,
yeah.
And like everybody. Yeah, just get them all back and... I think that'd be
It would be kind of neat to see. I mean, hell, they're making a Beverly Hills Cop 4 now. So.
Right, that's what I'm saying. They're doing all the sequels. Let's go. Let's Might do this well. One too. Come on,
I would
friend.
Be game for it. That's for sure. Though secretly, I kind of want a Monster Squad sequel because I've been waiting on it for 30-something years.
I'd rather have that one for real.
Yeah, but does Uncle Rico still play the werewolf?
Well, he's dead, right? They shoot him with silver bullets. So. Well,
but John Grease
let's get a new werewolf. We'll get a new werewolf.
Just bring him back. It's his own brother or something.
It's sure, his twin, yeah.
What, you mean what the Saw series should have done years ago? Tobin is Jigsaw had a brother because we keep putting him in this movie and it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, we forgot Tobin Bell is the only person that really knows what the hell he's doing in here besides Costa Mandalore. Dang.
Well, and Costas Mandalore has a perfectly serviceable brother who could have stepped into these movies too.
Oh, I did not know he had a brother.
Yeah, Lewis Mandalore.
I did not know his brother was anybody. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, he's also an actor.
I like that Ron positioned that as a perfectly serviceable brother.
Yes.
It's an acceptable replacement.
Versus, unlike the Dukes of Hazzard's other cousins.
He'll get the job done.
Coy and Vance are, that's fighting words in this town. But what are your final thoughts and popcorn ratings for Night of the Creeps? Because we're at that part of the podcast. Jerry, let's start with you.
This is like, so I married an ex-murderer. Excuse me, I believe I ordered the large cappuccino full of popcorn with drowning in butter, doing a slam poetry. So, yeah. That's what this is. So I love
Detective Cameron slam poetry I need in my life. So many
exactly.
Ways.
We have so many good ideas for how to make this remake this gosh. Movie. I mean,
no. Oh, that's great, Jerry. Ron, what about you?
Oh, this is not just an extra large popcorn. It's the whole popcorn machine. Just wheel it right into the theater.
Yeah.
Bring the whole gallon of butter flavored oil substitute, just get the bulk,
drink it
just
right
get the bulk
bottle.
Candy bin and just overturn it into the popcorn machine. Like, let's just do this thing. Let's just ruin just pull my teeth straight out of my head and cut my feet off. It's that level of like grease and sugar and butter and deliciousness and extra large popcorn with all the good stuff in it. And
doing shots
of
butter.
Just do the thing where you put the straw into the popcorn and use the straw to lower the butter into the middle and bottom of the popcorn bucket so you get a good even butter distribution. Or do the thing that they do at like the Alamo Drafthouse where they just bring you like essentially a wok full of popcorn that they've like tossed and buttered for you. Either way.
Yeah, those are great. Popcorn woks. Mm. Refillable. Mm-hmm.
Mm. All right, Lens, what about you?
Oh man. I came in and I was like, yeah, this is definitely a large popcorn. And now I want to play this extra large, refillable, shove candy up my butt game. We're going to boof popcorn butter. That's how good this movie is. I don't know if this is a PG-13 podcast right now. With my popcorn rating. No, I'm sure it's fine. I didn't swear.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Don't Google boofing.
I'm sure it's mentioned in some Supreme Court interviews that they did with old what's his name. So don't worry about it.
I'm sure.
And isn't that the name of his neighbor in
that's the girl next door in Teen Wolf.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Well, I will also give it an extra large popcorn with all the butter and nacho cheese.
Really nice.
Sounds good. I would do it. Just like a buttered nacho soup with popcorn on top. Because you have to have everything.
I'm into it.
This movie has everything. Mm-hmm. So should my popcorn.
I feel like I
might as well throw in some like cheese fries or chili fries.
I feel like underneath your popcorn, to catch all that delicious butter dripping, you need to put some of those soft pretzel bites.
Oh, yeah.
Just to soak it up. Yeah.
Wow. I'm into that.
So this movie is so many of my favorite things. And so my rating is going to be my two favorite snacks. It's extra large popcorn buttered with marshmallows in it too. Because if you've never done that, like, instant popcorn ball, you know, but without all the messy, more messy, but like more organic.
Anyway. What if you threw like chocolate chips or snow caps?
I have done right. White chocolate
or like Reese's Pieces or something.
Yeah, it works. Yeah. Any add-on will work just as well. It's all good. No, I love this movie. It's a childhood favorite. And that's the danger of coming back to these things years later. It's like, does it hold up? Will it work? And I've been pretty lucky. Most of the times when we've done them here that it's generally worked. And this one still does. It knows what it is. And I think that's why I really like this movie, is it doesn't pretend to be something it's not. And I know we talked about like Christopher Nolan makes these big pretentious movies and stuff, but you know what he likes? Stuff like this. Like this movie, Talladega Nights, like that's what he likes. And I'm like, that's awesome and hilarious, because you have to unplug your brain too. And that's exactly what this movie's for. So I highly recommend Night of the Creeps. If you haven't heard us, you know, make love to it here on this podcast for the last hour enough, that is condition enough. You need to get this one in front of your eyes, because it is definitely a fun one. And it goes down easy too. I mean, it's like 85 minutes. There's nothing to it. It blows by.
So easy.
Super I watched quick. An 85-minute movie that's a legacy prequel to a Stephen King, you know, property. We'll leave it at that. And I felt every second of the 87-minute runtime. So
I'm with you. I just did an episode. It hasn't dropped yet, but it was on a French Christmas film. It was the longest movie I've ever seen. And it was only like an hour and a half or less. And it was so long.
It wasn't Dow Code Santa Claus, was
like,
it?
Was
it Dow Code Santa Claus?
No, it was... I Believe in Santa Claus.
I don't know that one as much.
It's Yeah. I don't know the French name for it. It's awful.
Watch,
but if it's beloved by the French, I'm sorry. You know, that's... but oof. It's like a big
watch. Dow Code Santa Claus. It's the movie that Home Alone stole the idea for Home Alone 4.
There are now as many Home Alone sequels as there are Exorcist sequels, by the way, just so y'all know. So, which is amazing. Nice. Well, Jerry, thanks again for being a part of the podcast, wrapping up Shocktober with us here. Tell folks again how they can find you and all the cool stuff you got going on at Totally Rad Christmas.
Yeah, so totallyradchristmas.com is probably the easiest way. There are links to everything there. Or you can go to linktree.com/totallyradchristmas. Either way, we talk about Christmas in the 80s, and sometimes we'll talk about movies, TV, songs. We'll talk about books, fashion, fads, just anything. As long as it has anything to do with the 80s, we'll talk about it. And so, yeah, totallyradchristmas.com. And I've got some fun stuff coming up. Some of it's not super from the 80s, but I grew up with it, watching it, so I'm counting it. So it's like have y'all ever seen the Gundam War? No,
I've seen that. Yeah,
it is amazing, and it is like a bummer at the same time. It's so good, but also so traumatic and like depressing. And it's set at Christmas. It came out in 1989 in Japan. So we're covering that. And we got, of course, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, because I watched it every Christmas in the 80s, and a bunch of other random things that I'm sure you've heard of. But yeah, I don't want to list here. So yeah, it's just check it out. It's fun. And you will have just heard these three lovely people on the Jaws Revenge episode.
Yes, either the most romantic Lifetime movie with a shark in it, or the horniest shark movie ever made.
Little column A, little column
and
B,
little Michael.
So,
K.
You know,
imagine the Golden Bachelor meets.
Yes,
Golden Bachelor.
Yes, that's perfect.
That is
exactly what it is. A Golden Bachelor with a fin. Well, folks, thanks so much for tuning in to this episode. All our episodes of Shocktober. You can follow Jerry. All of this stuff is linked in our episode description and all of our other friends and stuff. And you can keep up with us at filmstrippodcast.com and on all the social medias at filmstrippod. You'll find announcements about upcoming shows, things like that. A lot of Ron's great humor, especially on Twitter and Blue Sky and all that. So follow those. And Ron has done a great job on our Facebook and Instagram pages of bringing up things from our back catalog that have anniversaries coming up and usually having a good twist on what we're talking about on the show. So check out our huge back catalog, get a part of that. We're on every podcast platform that you can find a podcast on: Apple, Spotify, Google, all that good stuff. Please share the show. Give us a positive review. It helps other people find the podcast. We appreciate the support. So for Jerry from Totally Merry Christmas, Lindsay and Ron, I'm Jay. Thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.